There are 9 jurors in a room. Your job? Convince this advisory committee of your drug's safety, that the benefit outweighs the risks. But here's the challenge. Only 2 of those jurors actually understand how your drug works and the system in the body that it targets. They're specialists. The other 7 are not. Under these circumstances, how do you convince a regulatory body that your drug is not only safe, but it's an essential therapy that changes the treatment paradigm and will transform patients' lives? I'm your host, Stephanie Sirota, Partner and Chief Business Officer at RTW Investments, and today I'm excited to welcome the CEO of UroGen Pharma, Liz Barrett. Before that, she served as CEO of Novartis Oncology and also held several senior leadership roles at Pfizer. Liz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And I have PTSD from your introduction.
Well, good. We're going to get into that. So tell us a little bit about your pharma journey. What is it like to climb the corporate ladder at a large company? And what do you attribute your success to, both at Pfizer and Novartis?
I would have never guessed I would be where I am today. I started my career at Kraft Foods and then went to Johnson & Johnson. Their biggest business was the pharmaceutical business. I always joke that I used to think it was really important what kind of toothbrush you used because I was the brand director on Reach toothbrushes. I actually started reaching out to people on the pharmaceutical side. I started at a small company called Orthobiotech. My sort of claim to fame is I launched the first DTC ever in oncology. It's hard to work in cancer and not feel very personal about it because either you experience it, someone close in your family, or you know someone who has had cancer. When I started in cancer 30 years ago, 5-year survival was actually very low. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was given an opportunity, and my career decisions have always been around where can I make the biggest impact, and am I being challenged? Am I learning? Am I giving?
Was it hard for you to make the transition from big pharma to biotech?
Actually, it wasn't. I've been able to be successful in large companies, but also had this in my mind that I would one day do the biotech thing. I was having too much fun. You know, things were going well. I was continuing to grow. When I got the call, I said, well, I'm not really ready at this time. And, Ari, who's our chairman, he just said, just come in and talk to us. And it was really after speaking to our chief medical officer, Mark Schomburg, who's still a practicing urologist, I was like, I've been in cancer for 30 years, and I really didn't know much about urothelial cancers. Nothing had really been done in this space. And the idea that we had a drug and a technology that worked. I saw the data, and it was very compelling. So being able to build a company at the same time, feel like you're really making an impact on patients and their lives, on human health, that was always very compelling for me. And that's why I finally made the jump.
That's great. What about the risks, though? I mean, even, early data doesn't always translate into getting across the finish line.
At the time, I guess I wasn't as worried. I had done well in pharmaceuticals. And I'm always a believer that, look, if it doesn't work out, I go back to big pharma if I really, really wanted to. So the risk wasn't really driving it so much as it was, will it be something that I can get excited about?
Let's get into the meat of UroGen.
Sure.
For context, let's assume that most of the listeners are not urologists. So in layman's terms, can you tell me about UroGen's pipeline? ZUSDURI and JELMYTO are your 2 drugs. Tell us a little bit about the patients that you're aiming to help.
Being a business person in a science world, you have to take the time to understand the science. We have a very unique, innovative technology that this chemist developed around urothelial cancers. Think about the upper tract of the urothelial as well as bladder cancer. Anytime you deliver medicine to an area in the urothelium, it just gets voided out very quickly with urine. But what you do is you put an active medicine, in the case of both of our products that are on the market now, it's mitomycin C, a well-known chemotherapeutic agent. If you use it either systemically or in aqueous solution in the body, there are side effects associated with it. Our gel, it allows it to release medicine over several hour time period. So when you think about it, one is delivered locally. You don't have the systemic side effects that you have with systemic chemotherapy. That's able to get to where typically these patients are treated with surgical procedures. And so the doctor goes in and literally cuts out the tumors in both the upper tract and in the bladder. But the problem is you can only cut out what you can see. In the upper tract, a lot of time, you can't even reach the tumor because it's behind the kidney. So what happens, these patients get their kidney removed. You're in a situation where the average age is, you know, in the 70s and 80s, and these patients are losing their kidney. Everybody knows that age alone is a factor for reduced kidney function. So even though, yes, you can live with one kidney, you don't prefer to live with one kidney. You are talking about from your kidney down to your bladder, and cancers grow throughout that area and then the bladder. They're very similar if you think about the actual cancer itself. They're both low-grade cancers. They're both urothelial cancers and genetically very similar. Physicians are excited about it, but patients are as well because the side effects mostly mild to moderate.
Are these cancers identified early on, or when do they get diagnosed?
Most patients will present with blood in the urine. Some will be high grade, some will be low grade. Non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, most patients actually do have a low grade. Bladder cancer isn't one disease. If you have high grade, there's a risk of progression, so you want to treat it more aggressively. And then obviously, as you get into muscle invasive bladder cancer, that's a different sort of situation.
And how long is the treatment?
Once a week for 6 weeks, and then you're done.
Because what is the recovery like? Do patients?
Recovery, there's not a lot of downtime. As a matter of fact, they can leave the office, go to the grocery store, go back to work.
Tell me a little bit more about the RT gel, the technology of your delivery mechanism, that it's novel. And I understand that it's a liquid when chilled, but then it solidifies
yes.
at body temperature. Tell us a little bit about why that is so important as an innovation in this area.
Right. It's a polymer-based technology. It's called RT gel because it's reverse thermal, which means that it's liquid when it's cold, if it's mixed with the active, and you put it in an ice bath before it turns to a liquid. And then as it hits the warm temperature of the body, it turns to a gel. For Zosduri, as an example, one of the details that we say is have a patient sit there for 15 minutes just to make sure, but it doesn't even take that long. If you actually held it in your hand, then you would see that it very quickly turns to a gel. And then again, disintegrates over a several hour time period with normal urine flow and is excreted from the body very naturally, not having any concerns about blockage or anything. It's a very elegant solution.
What other treatments are available to patients? Are you first line or?
For Jelmyto, we're for low-grade upper tract urothelial carcinoma, period. For the bladder, for Zosduri, it's for low-grade recurrent intermediate-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So we are a treatment for both low-grade tumors, and we actually are the only drugs approved in both of those areas. Now, it's been interesting since we've been there, now that the high-grade drugs are starting to do studies to come into our space, low-grade intermediate risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. So the market will get more crowded. Being in oncology for 30 years, people would ask me about competitors. More medicines for patients with cancer, the better. Because unfortunately, these aren't cures. Patients recur. So having more medicines on the market for patients is good for patients, and that makes it good for us.
And it's good competitively.
And to educate physicians. You know, we're changing behavior now. The current standard of care is surgical intervention. Without these medicines, they would just continue to do repetitive surgery. The more companies you have out there talking about alternatives, that's a good thing.
Okay, so let me take you back. On May 21st of this year, you attended an FDA panel assessing Zosduri's risk-benefit profile. And that must have been a really nerve-wracking moment for you. You sat there waiting for the votes to be cast. What was going through your mind?
I don't like to get ahead of my skis. When we had a break at the ODAC, things seemed to be going well. I said, guys, don't get ahead of yourselves. I've been to way too many ODACs in my time to know that anything can happen. I just remember sitting there being, don't make any facial expressions. You don't want anybody reading your face. I just remember closing my eyes at that point, just dropping my head. Dr. Pazder said, we think this is a split vote. You know, we'll be talking to the sponsor. But at the time, you're just like, I can't believe this.
For our listeners, the ODAC is the Oncology Advisory Committee, and there are permanent oncology voters on their panel. Now, it's up to them to invite specialists to join, which should have been urologists, but you only had two urologists that had been invited to join this panel of nine people. Was that worrisome that it wasn't sort of packed with specialists who knew the disease well?
Definitely. There's a benefit to being in the oncology division and then also a risk for urothelial cancers. They get treated by urologists. you would argue that maybe it should be in the urology division of the FDA, but because obviously it's cancer, it's in the oncology division. The positive about oncology division is they understand cancer and they are used to seeing drugs for the first time come into space. But the bad news is they do not understand urothelial cancers. I cannot tell you how many times we try to educate that low-grade cancers don't progress to muscle invasion. Every time we met with them, they kept bringing that up as the concern. We were happy with the two panelists that they did invite, but yes, we had hoped they would have invited a couple of others. And unfortunately, one of the permanent members is a kidney cancer doc specialist, but he wasn't there that day. So we did go in with the deck stacked against us.
So the vote was split 4 yeses to 5 noes. Right. So you were shy a single vote. So your stock dropped.
Yes.
By more than 50% down to like $4 a share. And normally it's quite difficult actually for FDA to approve a drug after a negative outcome like this. What was your reaction? Were you angry? Were you frustrated?
We actually already had planned time to debrief after the ODAC. We all go back to the room and everybody's, I think, just shell-shocked, just in shock. And I said, okay, I can't talk right now. I can't sort of debrief right now. I need to go and then we'll get back in touch. And I left alone. I got to the train station. I called Ari, who's our chairman. I always crack up about him because the reason I ended up at Urogen, I said, is he wouldn't take no for an answer. And that's exactly what he said to me. Don't take no for an answer. I said, okay, what are we doing? Let's figure this out. I'm a problem solver. I contacted Jim, who's our head of regulatory, and said, okay, I want you to reach out to them and say, Dr. Pazzo said, let's talk. So figure out when we could talk. I made a couple calls myself. It's kind of one of those things. We are going to do everything that we can to have a positive outcome here. So Dr. Pazdur agreed that he would come to our meeting in person. But the meeting wasn't for 10 days. And so you can imagine that the hardest time was those 10 days between the time we reached out to the FDA and we actually had our meeting. And when we had the meeting, they really understood how they confounded the issue by bringing up and asking, well, should we have randomized control studies? Well, you shouldn't ask that question right ahead of asking for approval of it on a single arm study. We had been perfectly fine with doing a randomized control trial. The problem is we couldn't get the FDA to agree. They wanted us to demonstrate superiority. They didn't want to do a placebo control study. We didn't want to do adjuvant. And the reason we didn't want to do adjuvant is part of the biggest benefit is you don't have to do surgery. So if you can get the type of results without doing surgery, why would you put patients through that? There was information that wasn't really clear to the panelists. What was interesting is they said they were only going to listen. So they sent us these questions and, you know, I said to the team, we will go in person. Mark sort of challenged them in the sense of, you know, we were definitely willing to do the study, but you guys didn't agree. And in my closing, I really talked about the fact that we had an agreement with the FDA. I mean, we're a small company. We never would have done a study that we didn't have agreement with the FDA if it could be the basis for an approval. And then I talked about my history in oncology and the compelling data and how important it was for patients. They also want to bring medicines that can help patients as well. We left there on a really, really good note. They said, okay, well, let us debrief and we'll get back to you. We got basically a draft label the same day after our meeting. But then we can't talk about it, right? So everybody's asking us questions and we went quiet. I left the FDA meeting and flew down to Florida for our national launch meeting. So I had to address our sales team, the entire commercial organization, without knowing whether we were going to get approval or not.
What about investors? Because did right. you have investors calling you up and asking you what
Absolutely.
Happened? Or so you had to juggle between like preparing, you know, for your FDA conversations, but then also the investor conversations.
We had to go dark, so we couldn't talk to investors. At that point, after the meeting, we were highly confident we were getting approval, but we couldn't tell anybody that, right? That gave us a little bit of air cover. I did say that we all still continued to feel like there was a path forward after the ODAC. It's so funny because after that event, somebody said, well, Liz looked really worried, you know, on the Zoom call. And it's amazing how investors try to read into everything you say and every facial expression that you make.
Everyone wants to try to glean something.
Right. And ultimately, you know, the FDA recognized the unmet need. So we were able to get ZUSDURI approved.
You have a poker face. They were wrong. We've been invested in UroGen for some time on the equity side and also on the royalty side. Right. Can you share a little bit about the relationship that you've developed with RTW?
We initially did the royalty deal with RTW, and RTW was not an investor in UroGen. And so I didn't really deal a lot with RTW, and our CFO did. And when she left, I called Tony, said, just wanted you to know, we're still open for business. Everything's great. That's when I started my sort of personal relationship with RTW. Over the years, it's been the best of relationships. RTW has invested a lot of money in our company, but they really want to support and guide, but without a heavy hand, if that makes sense. And for a CEO of a small publicly traded biotech company where the stock has been up and it's been down, there's nothing better than that. And so I'm very grateful to RTW, extremely grateful for the relationship that I built with Tony and Gotham and Rod over the years. And that's unique. I have a lot of confidence and a lot of belief and what we're doing and where we're going as a company, and could not ask for a better partnership than what we have with RTW. Oh,
thanks. We really appreciate that. I think, you know, one of the things that we strive to do is really have a depth of understanding, try to match that as much as we can to really understand what it is that you're working on, what challenges, you know, companies that we invest in are facing. Now, for our investor audience who's listening to this, you know, we all think about risk reward every day. How should they think about the uncertainty you face?
It is a show me story. All I can say is be patient. We still have a lot to prove. The people in the commercial organization will tell you that it's the hardest job they've ever had, down to the sales rep, because it's not a pill or an infusion. It's a procedure. So you sort of have this drug device. There's a lot of logistical and operational burden on the practice. And that's hard, because any physician, the key is to make sure it fits seamlessly into their practice. They're not about changing for you. We really have to do everything we can to make it as easy as possible on them. But you can only make it so easy because the drug has to get mixed. It has to get chilled. It's a more complex sell. And that's why we are trying to tell our investors, okay, you know, we are highly confident that this will be a successful launch and a successful medicine.
And you're trying to do this, you're self-commercializing. You're not, you know, partnering with pharma. And maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, why you feel like you're best equipped to do that.
The good news is, in this space, you don't need a large commercial infrastructure. And what's nice about it is we do have revenue with Jelmyto in a commercial organization. And yes, Jelmyto didn't end up being as big of a drug as we thought it would be. I think we set expectations. We expected it to be bigger, but I think we have been successful with Jelmyto. We definitely underestimated physicians around the operational logistical burden of it. And so things are so much easier with ZUSDURI to share the value with a larger company. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because again, we have a leverageable infrastructure that we have in place, so able to be able to do it.
Can we talk a little bit about, you know, your personal brand of leadership? What are some of the key tenets that you live by as CEO?
I'm kind of a direct communicator, right? I'm a big believer in integrity and honesty and transparency. Sometimes maybe too honest. What people that have worked for me talk about is that I was probably the hardest person they ever worked for, because I really challenged them, but they learned the most. And for me as a leader, there's probably nothing better that someone can say about you. You challenge your people, but you support them. So I've always been one of those willing to go to bat for us. And I can think of times where it's uncomfortable to do so. Over time, I learned, you know, to be a better leader by just coaching people. But I've worked with people where I'll give them feedback and they've been in their career 20 years. And they'll say, the first time I've heard that. When it really wasn't, it just no one sort of stepped up to talk to them. The role that I'm in today, that's a very fine line that you have to walk, because We're a publicly traded company, and you have to be very careful about what you say when. I had a boss at Pfizer that said to me, you know, you lead by your values. I would say that's probably what has driven me in the type of leader that I am.
I'm curious, are you the same person at work as you are at home?
No, I'm a pushover at home, although my kids would never say that at work. I'm never really satisfied. I'm always challenging people just to do a little bit better. I've, you know, challenged my kids to do that. Just be the best version of yourself. Do something you love. I didn't know that 30 years ago, but the ability to be able to make a living and doing what I love has been fantastic.
I've also kind of discovered, like later on in my Wall Street career of 25 years, that you know, when you love what you do and the people that you're doing it with, then it doesn't feel like work. But maybe tell us a little bit about why you do what you do. What is your why?
What we get to do is develop, discover medicines that have a huge impact on patients and on their families and really on the world. There's nothing better than that. I mean, I have meaning in my work, right? My kids, that's the meaning of my life. They're my world. When they get to see what their mother does, they're very proud. Since they were young, they also understood that I loved what I did. That makes a huge difference when you think about them and their lives and how they're going to grow. And so if you fortunate enough, as we both are, I think that there's no more meaning than that. I my mother died when I was 5 years old.
Oh, sorry.
And she died of a liver disease. She wouldn't die today, right? And I can't tell you how many people, when you think about cancer, my brother just, you know, is in remission from cancer, and how many people have impacted your life that have had cancer or died from cancer. But the fact that we get to be part of that solution and really helping people live better, longer lives, what more could you ask for?
No, that's unbelievable. We say the same thing at RTW. We, you know, get to participate in one little piece of this overall major innovation story. And, you know, we are really mission-driven investors, and it makes us feel, you know, like we're doing a little piece of good in that big puzzle. That
I guess the only thing I'll say is probably more than a little piece, because guess what? We couldn't do what we do if you didn't do what you do. And, you know, I did not appreciate that working for a large company. But boy, do I appreciate that working for a small biotech company.
Liz, thank you so much. It was wonderful to see you today, and I wish you continued success.
Well, thank you for having me.
The RTW podcast was produced and recorded by me, Devin Lever, at the RTW headquarters in New York, and edited by Dominique Guerra, with production coordinator Ying Yu Lin, and production support by Annabelle Chan. Executive Editorial Advisor was our partner, Chief Business Officer Stephanie Sirota, and Research Consultants were Partner and Research Analyst Tony Nguyen and Chief Corporate Finance Officer Chris Sider. Now you can follow along in the format you prefer. Watch the video feed of this podcast on YouTube or read the transcript at rtwfunds.com/podcasts. To make sure you never miss an episode, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on LinkedIn at RTW Investments LP and check out our website for the latest updates and insights. This interview was given by Liz Barrett, CEO of Eurogen, and moderated by Stephanie Sirota, Partner and Chief Business Officer at RTW Investments. Statements reflect RTW's views and opinions as of the date hereof, and not as of any future date. All expressions of opinion are subject to change without notice and are not intended to be a forecast of future events or results. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent.